Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
In these days of the coronavirus, John and I are in separate places, both at home, but the show must go on. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month. But first, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Well, Dave, usually when I go through my news roundup of spaceflight and astronomical topics that have interested me over the last month, I start in low Earth orbit and work my way out. But today it's just got to be different because of such an important piece of news that was revealed on only mid-month, the 14th of September. The idea that possible life signs have been discovered somewhere where you wouldn't expect them. Whenever we think about life elsewhere in the solar system, the candidate is always Mars. You know, has there been, is there now, life on Mars? And so many of the rovers or landers that have gone down to the surface of Mars have been equipped with laboratories or the capability of looking for whether conditions could have supported life in the past or indeed now. And we have spacecraft orbiting Mars, sniffing for methane, which again could be a byproduct of their having been life, or being life now. So nobody really expected that the possibility of life would be first detected on Earth's evil twin, Venus. Now, we call it Earth's evil twin because it's such a hellhole of a place. It's about Earth-sized, but, the surface is so hot that it's hot enough to melt lead. And that's because of a runaway greenhouse effect there. Heat comes from the sun through the clouds onto the surface, warming it up, bounces back up to the clouds, but can't get through and escape again. And so bounces back and heats the atmosphere. And so it keeps warming and warming. Not only is it incredibly hot on the surface, but it's incredibly dense atmosphere. It's something of the order of 18 or so times the pressure felt on the surface of Earth. So totally inhospitable. But that's the surface. But if you go a little bit higher, say 50 kilometres high, then it's almost shirt sleeve in terms of temperature and pressure. Apart, of course, from the clouds. Now, on Earth, we have nice, friendly clouds made of water vapour. On Venus, which is covered in clouds, they're made of sulfuric acid. Not the sort of thing that supports life. So, it really was quite a surprise to a team from Cardiff University. They were sort of gearing up to study exoplanets, thinking about, you know, what we would we look for when we can start to develop the technologies for looking for traces of gases in the atmospheres of exoplanets, that is, planets around other stars outside of our solar system. So they thought, well, Venus would be a very useful standard to set for a place where this won't happen. So they set the James Clerk Maxwell radio telescope looking at Venus to measure a spectrum there of, and they actually discovered phosphine. Now, phosphine is a gas. And on Earth, it only exists where it's either produced in factories, there ain't no factories on Venus, or it's produced by what are known as anaerobic bacteria. And that means that, bacteria that doesn't breathe oxygen. So, for example, in the insides, in the guts of penguins, we have that kind of bacteria that produces phosphine. Apparently, penguin poo is full of the stuff. Now, they thought this can't be right. So they checked their data again and again and again. and all of the time it's there. So they then got a really huge radio telescope to check this out. That's the ALMA telescope in Chile, an array. Eventually they got permission to use that, and that confirmed their findings without the shadow of a doubt. Phosphine exists in the higher clouds of Venus, but it's known to be a short-lived gas. So in the quantities that are found on Venus, it can only be there if it's being continually replenished. In other words, something, can't be a factory, is churning it out. So what the researchers have done, they've got all sorts of other people and organisations involved. They've replicated all of the possible ways it could be produced under the pressure, temperature, chemical circumstances of that environment, modelled it, and it's, they've come up with a blank. They cannot explain in any circumstances how this could exist. So to quote, well, not really Sherlock Holmes, but his creator, Arthur Conan Doyle, who said, via Sherlock Holmes, "When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." So the only cause left is that there are microbes floating in the clouds of Venus, somehow surviving. But it is a toxic environment, so how they've done that, we just don't know. But, you know, those clouds will have got more and more toxic. Maybe the microbes have evolved over time. Maybe they've developed some kind of armour to enable them to operate in that kind of environment. But it's not proof. But we now believe it's highly probable that there is indeed life elsewhere in the solar system on our twin sister planet, Venus. Listeners will find on the slides that I've included a couple of light-hearted drawings. These were by Patrick Moore's mother, who used to delight in painting watercolours of what she imagined life to be like on all of the planets studied by her son Patrick. When I was a little boy, I used to go down to Patrick Moore's telescope, driven down by my mum and dad. And so I met Gertrude Moore, and we used to get Christmas cards every year with some of these drawings on. So do have a look at them. How I wish I'd kept those Christmas cards, but when you're a little lad, it doesn't seem quite so so important. But they're quite sweet, these little drawings. But what a staggering concept, life elsewhere in the solar system. At the start of that item, I talked about life on Mars, so let's return to Mars now. The European Space Agency's Mars Express orbiter in 2018 hinted at there being a large subsurface lake of liquid water buried under Mars's southern ice cap, and that's about 1.5 kilometres deep. Now, studies using data from Mars Express since then have now confirmed, it's only just been announced, this is breaking news, that lake is definitely there. And what's more, we've got its size now, about 30 kilometres long, 20 kilometres across. And it's not alone, it's also surrounded by three other small lakes or ponds, but again of liquid subsurface water. Now, for the water to be liquid, it has to be exceedingly salty or briny. It's so close to the surface at 1.5 kilometres that there couldn't be any volcanic heat keeping it warm, stopping it from freezing. So it has to be very, very briny. So they've discovered, you know, this little system of lakes. So they're posing the question now, maybe there's a much larger network of underground lakes elsewhere. Certainly, though, these must be a target for missions in the future, because wherever there's water on Earth, no matter how briny, how hot, how cold, there's life. Could there be life in these salty lakes under the Martian surface? Who knows? Okay, time to get back to some nearer-to-Earth spaceflight-type topics. So this month, NASA has published its a bit more detail of its plans for its Artemis mission back to the Moon. If you remember, Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo. And, of course, it was the Apollo missions that took man to the Moon in 69. So the cost is going to be a staggering $28 billion. But what NASA needs urgently, they need congressional approval to release $3.2 billion over the next few months. And that is for the development of the lunar lander. Now, this is a commercial contract with three different companies at the moment who are submitting plans, and NASA will be selecting the winner. But they've got to provide the funding for that development. They've also announced that for the very first landing, manned landing, that is, something called Gateway will not be needed. Gateway is like a mini International Space Station, which will be constructed and put into orbit around the Moon. It'll be a halfway house where astronauts from Earth will dock and prepare and transfer to a landing craft at the Gateway and then descend to the surface. But they won't need that for the very first landing, but will need it for the later missions, which are tasked with setting up a manned base near the South Pole, where there is known to be icy deposits in the bottom of the craters at the South Pole. And there's ice there because some of these craters near the South Pole are so deep that the sun never rises and shines into the depths of those craters. So water, presumably carried there by asteroids and so on, comets that have hit at some time in the past, that water is still there and will be essential for refining, for use by the crew, but also for refining into fuel and for construction materials. So the details of the first three missions are as follows. Artemis 1, which is scheduled for late 2021, is an uncrewed one-month mission. This will be by an Orion spacecraft, which is NASA's spacecraft for deep space missions, and that will be launched on an SLS, Space Launch System, rocket, which is a massive beastie under construction at the moment. So that will be putting this Orion spacecraft into orbit around the Moon and varying that orbit to fully test out all of the systems on board the Orion capsule and its service module, which is built by the European Space Agency. Now, following on from that, Artemis 2 will take place 2 years later, in late 2023, and that's going to be a manned mission, a 10-day mission, but not orbiting, but looping around the moon. It's going to go out further than any manned mission has gone before. But it'll be on a free return trajectory, which means it'll loop around the moon, then head back to Earth for a splashdown and recovery in the Pacific under the watchful eyes of the US Pacific Fleet's recovery vessels. Artemis 3 is the manned one, which will land on the moon, and that is scheduled for the following year, October 2024. And that will have perhaps a four-person crew in the Orion, two of whom, one male, one female, will transfer into a pre-positioned lunar lander. So a lunar lander will be launched, put into orbit around the moon. The Orion will dock with it, and two will transfer, one male, one female, and then they'll descend onto the moon for a one-week stay. So it's taken a long time to get back there, and the Jim Bridenstine, the NASA director, says that the Trump declared target date of by end of 2024 is aggressive, his words, but is doable. But they do need the funding and at the right time. And there's nothing like having a timetable, a date to strive to meet, and let's hope they can do that. Exciting times indeed. Well, it's that time to have a look and see what SpaceX have been doing. Well, early in the month, they launched yet another batch of 60 or thereabouts Starlinks, but they did have one scrubbed just a few days ago because of bad weather. And that's put off for about a week because it now has to wait for some military launches from Cape Kennedy. They've also been continuing testing of the prototypes for their next generation of spacecraft, of course, called Starship. So there's another one, this time SN6, Starship prototype number 6, has made an identical hop of 150 metres, going up, flying sideways, landing on a different pad, identical to the one made last month by SN5, which was called a flying grain silo, because it just looks like a big tube flying through the air. They've also deliberately destroyed yet another prototype when they popped it in a pressure test. So as a result, they learn about what maximum pressures, you know, their fuel tanks can sustain. And that's the way SpaceX works. Continual stepwise refinement, gradually refining and refining until they get it just right. Elon Musk has said that for the next hop, which is going to be a bit more adventurous, they will need an aerodynamic nose cone and fins fitted to the prototype. So that means it's probably the one that's aiming for somewhere between 12 and 20 miles high. Now, SpaceX are also working with another commercial company called Axiom Space. And this company has just announced that the first all-private mission to the ISS is going to take place next year in October. And that will be using a SpaceX Falcon 9 and a Crew Dragon. It's going to have three fare-paying passengers on board, but in addition to them, there will be a professional astronaut. This is Michael Lopez Alegria, who used to be a NASA astronaut until he retired and went into the commercial sector. He went up to the ISS three times, in fact, and was the station commander at one point. So very experienced. Last thing about SpaceX, their first operational flight to the ISS has been put back by about a week, 8 days in fact, to Halloween, the 31st of October. NASA has announced that over the last few days. Having talked about SpaceX and their Starlink broadband satellites, that brings me on to one of their competitors. You might remember that OneWeb, a company that was launching a similar large constellation of broadband global satellites, they went bankrupt, having just launched some. But the UK government has bought them with a view to perhaps using their capabilities as a replacement for the Galileo sat-nav-type project that will be excluded from after Brexit. But it wasn't only bought by the UK government. We went 50% in with an Indian telecommunications company. Anyway, the news about OneWeb is they've just announced that they're about to begin launching more of their broadband satellites so that they can fulfil the conditions of the takeover. So they've arranged a revised contract with Arianespace, with whom they work to provide the launch capability. And 36 satellites are going to be launched using a Soyuz booster with a Fraget upper stage. And that will be launched from Baikonur in Kazakhstan in December. So they've said that the full constellation of OneWeb satellites, that'll be 648 of them, should be completed by the end of 2022. So there'll be far fewer of those than there are of Elon Musk's Starlink satellites. That's because the OneWeb satellites are in a higher orbit and each of them has a further broadband footprint, if you wish. Going a little further afield, China has just launched a mystery spacecraft. Now, they're fairly secretive with most of their launches, but they usually do announce them in advance and provide some official photographs. But neither of those things happened on a launch that was on September the 4th. And this was by their big Long March 2F launcher, which is a man-rated launcher. And all they will say is that the craft was an experimental, reusable spacecraft. So the very secretive nature of this launch indicates a military aspect, and it's thought that this might be perhaps something like the American, well, the USAF's X-37B space plane that we've talked about a few times before. Looks like a mini shuttle. Anyway, this particular craft spent 2 days in orbit and apparently manoeuvring in orbit, and is then believed to have landed at a military airbase, because if it is like the X-37B, then it comes down is a sort of winged vehicle and lands on a runway. I've mentioned in the past how exoplanets are mostly discovered, and that's by looking to see a slight dip in the light emitted by a star when one of its planets passes in front of it. So that identifies here is a candidate as an exoplanet, and then it's examined again to make sure that it occurs on a regular basis and it's known that a planet is orbiting. So there's one that's just been confirmed. It was initially discovered in 2017 by the Kepler Space Telescope, and now confirmed, in fact, by a ground-based network of telescopes called Speculoos. And it's been dubbed Planet Pi, P-I. Now, it's called, it's been given a delightful little name of K2-315b, and it orbits its star once every 3.14 days, hence the name, travelling at 181,000 miles an hour. It's believed to be a terrestrial planet with a radius slightly less than that of the Earth, 95% that of the Earth. But what's interesting from this study is that initially when the first exoplanets were discovered, they tended to be Jupiter-sized. But as our techniques have improved, our researchers are able to discover planets of a much smaller than Jupiter, and now, as we can see, it's down to Earth size. But using the techniques that they used on this particular confirmation, the researchers say that they believe we should be able to get down to detecting exoplanets about as small as Mars. So that's a great stride forward. They finished off their report with a nice little line about the planet, saying its surface temperature is estimated at 176 degrees C, and that's hot enough to bake a pie. Dough. Well, here's another exoplanet item for you. For the first time ever, an intact exoplanet has been discovered orbiting the type of star that we call a white dwarf. Now, this was discovered by NASA's TESS mission, which stands for Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, co-discovered with the Spitzer Space Telescope. Now, this star is 80 light-years away, and the planet, which has been catalogued as WD1856b, is large. It's a Jupiter-sized planet and goes round its parent star every 34 hours. But the interesting thing is, here, we've got a planet that is seven times bigger than its star. And that star is only just a little bit bigger, well, 40% larger than the Earth. And ordinarily, of course, it's the other way round. Our Earth is tiny in comparison with the Sun. Even Jupiter, which is 12 times bigger than the Earth, is tiny compared to the Sun. So a white dwarf is so called because it is a really minuscule sun. It's produced when something like our sun stars, when it swells at the end of its life and becomes what's called a red giant, which means its diameter just continually expands. And at the very end of its life, it'll throw off most of its outer layers and then collapses, the rest of it collapses into a highly compressed, dense core. So as it will have expanded, all of its planets will have been destroyed because they'll have been, or most of them will have been destroyed because it will have swelled outside their orbit, so it would have swallowed them. Any planets that are further out that later migrated in to the star because of the change in the gravitational field of the star, as they approach the star, would tend to be torn to shreds because of the extremely high gravitational field. However, this one seems to be in a very stable orbit, and it's believed that it's been like that for millions, if not you know, billions of years. So it's the first one like this that's ever been seen, and they really don't know quite why this one has survived. A few ideas are that perhaps as it migrated in slowly, some passing object caused it to slow its migration, and so it entered a stable orbit rather than just carrying on headlong too close to its star, where it would have been destroyed. Or maybe because there are other stars very close by, maybe the combined gravitational fields of these other stars are perturbing what would otherwise have been a headlong rush and have caused this stability in its orbit. But every time that researchers come up with something new like this, they're learning more and more about how solar systems evolve, how they die, and how they behave. So an interesting first there. It's only within the last few years, of course, that gravitational waves have been detected. But since the first detection, they've been coming along on a fairly regular basis. Now, on the 1st of September, it was announced that the largest ever merger of two black holes has just been detected by the three gravitational wave detectors. That's the two LIGO ones in the United States and the Virgo one in Italy. It was not only the largest merger, but it's also the most distant one ever observed, 7 billion light years away. But let's have a look at this size issue. 142 solar masses was the size of the resulting black hole following the merger of the two. The components were 85 and 65. Now, if you add those up, that comes to 150. Yet the result was 142 solar masses. So what that means is that eight times the mass of our sun was converted into energy, including gravitational waves, in the 1/10 of a second that this merger took. So what was particularly interesting to scientists about this was that up until now they've been aware of two different classes of black hole. Ones that are just a few tens of the mass of our sun, and these are called stellar mass black holes. And then there are supermassive black holes, which are millions of times the mass of our sun. And those are the sorts of things that are to be found usually in the core of galaxies. And indeed, we have one in the core of the Milky Way. Now, an intermediate size black hole had been theorised and postulated, but had never been observed until now. So this observation has provided the proof for that theory. So with that news, that concludes my look at the items of spacecraft and astronomical interest that tickled me over the last month.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars Over Surrey, Constellation of the Month.
So what is the constellation of the month then, John?
My constellation of the month for October, Dave, is Cassiopeia. An easy one to find. It's virtually overhead. And it's made up of five bright stars forming a W shape, or an M if you're looking t'other way up. Mostly second magnitude stars. how the ancients saw this W shape as a queen sitting in a throne, it quite escapes me. But it's a splendid constellation, easily recognisable, and sitting right across a good bright patch of the Milky Way. So it contains two Messier objects, a couple of Patrick Moore's Caldwell objects too, some nice double stars, even a triple star. So just sweep with binoculars across the W of Cassiopeia and you'll see a myriad of stars. Really is a nice constellation.
John will be going through What's Up for October in a short while, but just before that, here's an interview he recorded about something important going on this coming weekend.
Okay, everybody, so I'm John Extor from Stars Over Surrey, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Chantal Nobbs, who's from the UK Atomic Energy Authority. Now, Chantal is not only a researcher there, but she's also chair of the Institute of Physics at South Central Branch, and has taken on the job of organising the local events for World Space Week. So, Chantal, with all of this pandemic, that last year we were able to do things like have great fun in the High Street at Guildford with telescopes and so on. But this year it must be so difficult. So what's going to happen? What are people going to see?
Yeah, exactly right. So so last year we had all kinds of hands-on activities on the High Street, whereas this year we've had to create a virtual event. So we hope again to have, well, all of our activities are going to be free and everything is going to be available online. And the there'll be quite a wide selection of different activities available on each day, quite similar to last year. But now, because it's virtual, we can spread it out across the full week of World Space Week. So our events start on the 4th of October, so Sunday, the 4th of October. And we're going to start with at lunchtime, 12 till 1, the Guildford Astronomical Society are going to, hopefully, weather permitting, give us a live solar telescope session and also give us some advice about how to use telescopes at home and get involved in astronomy at home. Then moving into the afternoon on the Sunday, between 3 and 4 p.m., we're going to have a live online lecture, and that's given by Elizabeth Surrey from the University of Surrey.
Good.
Elizabeth Cunningham from the University of Surrey. And then moving on more into the afternoon, between 5 and 6 p.m., we are going to have a fantastic talk. about the Sputnik in context. So sort of very relevant for this event.
It's on its birthday, so we have to do it then.
Absolutely, yeah. Perfect timing indeed. So then, so those are Sunday's events. Then moving on to Monday, we're going to kick off our craft-based lunchtime activities. So between 12 and 1, throughout all of the weekdays, we're going to put loads of links online to craft-based activities that people can get involved with, including tutorials on how to get involved in macrame and things like that. Moving on to the Tuesday, in the morning between 10:30 and 11:30, we're going to have a live storytelling session from Elizabeth Avery, and she's going to be reading her book, which is Ted's Space Adventures, this is an activity really that's aimed for ages 3 to 5. So it's for our younger audiences to sit and have a live storytelling session.
Well, those of us in our second childhood can still dip in.
Absolutely, yeah. Fun for everyone. And then also on the Tuesday, we're going to have a Guide to Fake News workshop. So there's an activity that is currently online that people can get involved with and see if you can figure out the fake news articles. And then in this workshop, we just have a Q&A going through those and talking about fake news a bit more and how to decipher it, which is very relevant for the media at the moment.
Isn't it just? But no politics involved in this
politics.
Event.
Yeah. All space themed.
Good.
So they're moving on to the Wednesday. We're going to start our World Space Week storytelling sessions on Facebook Live, again aimed at ages 3 to 5. And these are talks that we do alongside Guildford Library and the other libraries across the South Central region. So we'll be starting with Molly and the Moon on Wednesday, the 7th of October, 10:30 to 11, having a storytelling session there, and then the following 2 Wednesdays as well. And then on the Thursday, the 8th of October, we'll have our second live lecture. This will be in the evening, 5 till 6 p.m., with David Wilkinson from the IOP. And he's going to be talking about science fiction writing, which is very exciting. Moving then on to Friday, the 9th of October. We're going to have a space theme virtual quiz. We'll be giving away some great prizes, so it's a really good thing for families to get involved with. It'll all be done online. So check that out on Friday. Saturday, which is the last day of our World Space Week set of events, we're going to have a live reveal show from MPL. So MPL, throughout this week, actually starting yesterday, are running an online challenge, an online activity called Where on Earth Am I? And
Yes.
it's a GPS-based challenge. So it's about understanding how GPS is affected by buildings. And so they've got that online challenge for people to get involved with beforehand. And then on Saturday the 10th, between 2 and 3 p.m., we're going to have a live results show to actually see what was found. And so those are the activities that are happening on each of the individual days. We're also going to have activities running throughout the week. So this will involve an egg drop challenge. So it's about finding bits and pieces around your home, straws, bubble wrap, all that kind of thing. Seeing if you can land, drop a raw egg from 3 meters and make it land without breaking. And again, so we're giving away really good prizes for that. And we just want people to sort of send us their videos of them doing the challenge.
Oh, that's fun.
And something to get involved with. We're also doing a walk, run, cycle the solar system. So a fun run, but you can also walk and cycle. And that's being run through Strava. And we're giving away medals for anyone who reaches the Earth. So we've scaled the whole solar system down so that the sun to Earth distance is 5 kilometers. And then all the planets are then scaled appropriately. And so we're seeing who can get the furthest in our solar system.
Excellent idea.
Week, and of course the MPL activities running all week as well to get involved with. So the best way really for people to find out, because all these links are online, there's all different places where you can go and participate in these activities. So the best place for you to just see all of that in one place is if you head over to our Facebook page, the Institute of Physics South Central branch, or at IOPSCB. And we also are on Twitter as well, and we're sharing all these activities there. So it's IOP South Central. So we've got various events that you can register to via Facebook and find out the links to on Twitter. If you register, then you sort of get all those updates as they come through. And we hope that there'll be something for everyone in this mix of virtual events happening.
It sounds a splendid range of activities, and for such a wide set of ages as well. I always think with astronomy, it's get them young. It's either space or dinosaurs, and if we can interest people early, they could be sort of amongst the first astronauts on Mars. Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, anything's possible.
Or perhaps even to Venus, now that we know there's possibly life there. Okay, well, Chantelle, thank you ever so much for that overview, and I will encourage everybody to get out there and take part. And presumably, as this is a worldwide series of events, so we can cast our net a little bit further and pick up some of the broadcasts done by other centres as well. So, okay, Chantelle, well, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
I'll see you there on the 4th of October.
Absolutely.
Okay.
the month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Thanks, Dave. Certainly sounds as though there's going to be some interesting activities there for people to get involved with. OK, let's get back to the night sky for October then. It's a good time of year. I always like this for the night sky. We've got some of our familiar summer constellations still there, like Bootes and Hercules, Aquila. And then things like Cygnus, last month's constellation of the month, and this month's Cassiopeia. But we've also got some that will be with us for the rest of the winter, really. Things like Pegasus, Andromeda, Perseus, Auriga and Taurus starting off as well. So a mixture of our summer skies and our winter skies, and a few planets around as well. If you're wanting to go and do a bit of moon watching, then the best time of the month will be around new moon. The first quarter of the moon at the 23rd. You know, give or take a few days either side. But if you're wanting to do some deep sky objects, then you don't want the moon casting its bright light all over the sky. So the new moon is on the 16th. The nights, of course, are getting longer. The sun is rising later and later at the start of the month, just gone 6 o'clock. By the end of the month, it's about 7 o'clock, and that's even adjusting for summertime as well. So in terms of planets, they're pretty well all visible, all apart from Mercury. Venus is just fantastic in the mornings, blazing away at magnitude minus 4.1 in the east in the morning. Mars is at its best this month. It's best seen when it is at its highest in the south about midnight. But, you know, we'll be there from in the east from or southeast from early evening. And it is now brighter than Jupiter, or it reaches its brightness this month. Magnitude minus 2.6. And you can't mistake its coppery, pinkish-red colour. Jupiter itself is unmistakable in the south as night falls. Very bright indeed, minus 2.2. It's there in our evening skies all month, but gradually getting closer to the horizon as the month goes on. And it's followed not far behind by Saturn, you know, just to the left as we look at it, in other words, to its east, low in the south as evening falls, but not as bright. It's a positive magnitude of plus 0.8, 0.8, that is. But when you turn a telescope on it, you'll see that its rings are nicely presented, nice and open. Even binoculars will show it as not round, but an oval sort of shape. That's the rings that you're seeing. You'll need telescopes for both Uranus and Neptune, but both of those are positioned in the evening sky very nicely. A few things to watch out for in October. Conjunctions on the 3rd, the Moon will be just 1 degree away from Mars, but that is in the morning before sunrise. But also on the same day, quite interestingly, Venus will be very, very close to the first magnitude star, Regulus, which is the main star of the constellation Leo. They rise together at about 3:30, and they're so close that they're only 11 arc minutes away from each other. Now remember, there are 60 arc minutes in 1 degree, so 11 or thereabouts arc minutes is, well, just about, more or less, one-tenth of a degree away. So that will make quite an interesting sight. Got a couple of meteor showers this month. On the 8th we have the Draconids, and on the 20th we have the Orionids. The peak of the Orionids, the theoretical maximum, is 25 per hour, compared to the Draconids, just 10 per hour. But the Orionids are fast-moving meteors, whereas the Draconids are slower ones. So they might be easier to spot around the 8th. And do remember, of course, these theoretical maxima are under perfect conditions, which we just don't have. No light pollution, etc., etc. Back to pairings. The Moon and Venus make a nice pair on the 14th, before sunrise, separated by about 4 degrees. And we've got the same kind of separation twice more with different planets and the Moon. On the 22nd, it's Jupiter and the Moon making a nice pairing, 4 degrees apart. And on the 29th, it's Mars and the Moon. So both of those are evening pairings. Of course, local societies are still suffering from the pandemic in terms of not having physical meetings. They are continuing for with Zoom meetings, but of course that has to be for paid up members to cover the cost of setting up that sort of thing. So you might consider joining one of our local societies, Guildford, Farnham, Croydon, Yule or Walton. The slides that support this programme list the websites for all of those societies, so do take a look and see what they're doing. We've got some free Zoom sessions that hopefully you'd be interested in. So again, I'll refer you to the slides where the details are listed, and these are free ones put on by the big societies, things like the Royal Astronomical Society, the British Astronomical Association and the Society for Popular Astronomy. All three of those have very interesting and free sessions. The BAA's one is on the 14th of October in the evening at 7 o'clock. It's about astronomical images. The Royal Astronomical Society's one is a Tuesday lunchtime, 13th of October, about the European ExoMars mission. On the a Saturday afternoon, we've got the Society of Popular Astronomy's talk, and that one will be about exploring an ever-changing universe. There's another one that's run by a commercial company called Go Space Watch, and it's a very low fee that you have to pay to join those talks, just £3. And this one, they've got two this month of interest. Certainly I'm going to sign up for the first one. It's about going back to Pluto with a mission called Persephone. And it's run by Dr. Carly Howitt, who is the principal investigator of Persephone. So that's to send a craft to orbit Pluto. So that's Wednesday the 7th of October in the evening at 7:30 for a couple of hours. Another one on the 21st of October, my journey into astrophotography by an astroimager called Roger Hyman. I won't be watching that because that's my birthday. I hope to be doing other things. both of those just £3. And as I say, Go Space Watch, and the slide has the appropriate link for you. And Sky at Night on television It's the programme that should have been on in September, but was bounced to October because of the special that they ran on the 14th of September, when they announced that fascinating story about the possibility of life on Venus. So this month's pro edition is called Beyond the Visible. And the BBC's advertising literature reads as follows. This month, the team find out how astronomers are learning about the universe by looking beyond visible light, exploring radio astronomy, the unusual sounds that space missions have captured of the cosmos, and the detection of ripples in space-time known as gravitational waves. This episode is about how so much more can be detected by studying the unseen. The one firm date I've got for this is first broadcast will be on Sunday the 11th of October, as usual, on BBC Four at 10 p.m. But I don't have the date confirmed yet for the repeat. But usually it's on the following Thursday. So I expect it will be on Thursday the 15th, BBC Four again, 7:30. But you will need to check with your newspaper or the Radio Times, or go onto the BBC's website to find out. It's not yet published there. So there we are. That's it, Dave and listeners. That's my look at what's up in the night sky for October.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insight. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items in that we couldn't fit into the broadcast.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.